This is Parker, and you're listening to Coach Your Brains Out.
That was Parker, our first ever Coach Your Brains Out patron. If you enjoy the show and get something out of it, you too can become a supporter at patreon.com/coachyourbrainsout. Other new patrons of the show include Barbara Mayer, Jeremy Schmidt, Peter King, Keegan Cook, and Melanie Hambleton. Thank you all for making this show possible. And as Tier 2 patrons, a few of you will get to pose a question for the show. Tier 3 patrons get a Coach on One, a 30-minute chalk talk with some hosts. So head on over to patreon.com/coachyourbrainsout to become a Coach Your Brains Out regular giver.
Cyborg.
Welcome to Coach Your Brains Out, the show that explores learning from the top minds in volleyball and beyond. With your hosts, John Mayer, Billy Allen, Andrew Fuller, and Nils Nielsen.
Today we're joined by Todd Maddox, the head indoor volleyball coach at the Bishop School. Todd is also the executive director of the Starlings Volleyball Club. I know Starlings is not your typical club. Can you maybe tell us more about it and about your involvement?
Well, about a year ago, I was trying to edge into retirement, so I stopped teaching at the Bishop School and thought I was going to be doing a little more surfing, but Starlings was in a situation where Byron Schumann, the founder, turned 70, and he was experiencing some health issues, so I stepped in, and all of a sudden, I'm not very close to retired, but it's been great. We have some great people involved, and we have about 500 players in San Diego, and we just held our nationals in San Diego with 121 teams. So it was Alicia Glass was our keynote speaker. It was a great event. So we're excited at what we have going both in San Diego and national, and we're also excited. We're looking at a grassroots program to really try to transform the way volleyball is taught in underserved communities. So has a coaching education component to it. So we're excited about that. And that's the latest on the Starlings front.
That's awesome. For people who don't know about Starlings, can you just tell us how it's maybe different than your typical volleyball club?
Yeah, well, Starlings started in 1996 at Lincoln High in San Diego, and that's in Southeast San Diego. Some listeners might know about Marcus Allen, Terrell Davis. That was their alma mater. Byron and Kim Oden started coaching one team at Lincoln in 1996, and now we have about 2,000 participants in Starlings, and it's a club that's really set up to provide opportunities for kids who can't afford the regular volleyball clubs, and that's what it was set up to do in its original form, and we're still working on that today. So it's we have some great people, many of whom volunteer their time and give countless hours to try to provide experiences for kids to enjoy our great game.
Well, it's a great thing. I'm glad it's going well, because I think it's too bad that too often our sport, players have to be in a socioeconomic status to pay for club, and that's how they can get seen by college coaches. So I'm glad there's, a club like Starlings.
We're battling that, but we have some great people involved, and that's really what keeps us fired up, is the people that we have working with us. It's fun to work there. So
that's great. Well, for today, our topic is understanding your biases. And I know you presented on this topic at the AVCA convention over the holiday break over in winter. So I'm wondering, just to start, kind of what drew you to this topic?
Well, it's a story that has some connections to some of your recent guests. I've been coaching volleyball since the 1980s, the early 80s I started. So I've been doing this a while, and I always look back to things I thought were true 10 years ago, and then 10 years ago, I was, absolutely sure that this was the way to teach passing. And now 10 years have passed, and I think, that's not so great. So those things are always interesting to me as far as my evolution of what I believe to be true as a coach. The biggest one was really speed of offense and really slowing down our middle attack. And so I went about I think it was, it had to be the Olympics. What we had, the 12 Olympics, I think. I went up to St. Mary's, and Rob was at the Olympics, so I was hanging out with Keegan and Brent. They were the assistants there, trying to glean everything I could from their program. And I used to think that you needed a great setter in order to set fast to the pins. And I don't believe that anymore. So I think you can train it, and it's made a world of difference for our program. So just that one key thing that I believed for some 20-something years, you know, got me thinking that, hey, what are the other things that I believe that aren't true?
And in the presentation, you begin with some takeaways from Michael Lewis's book, Moneyball. Can you just kind of explain to listeners or remind them what some of those takeaways are?
Well, in general, baseball scouts were seen in Moneyball as being subjective. So they loved the physical quality of that five-tool baseball player. So they loved big, handsome guys that ran fast, threw the ball a long way, and hit the ball a long way. And all of their, a lot of their analyses were based on what things, just their eyesight, what it looked like. And Moneyball really came, it was really the start of heavy-duty statistical analysis. And that rubbed a lot of people in baseball, being as traditional it was, the wrong way. And that was the start of the Moneyball craze there, and it's that statistical models can be created to better evaluate players than the old scouts.
And can you take us through kind of what some of the things they found in Moneyball?
Yeah,
for the baseball side.
So they used to think about batting average, and then in Moneyball they started with the on-base percentage plus slugging percentage combined to form OPS, and that was a new statistic. And then from there, the idea was, okay, well, how do you get on base more? And then that was narrowed down to a specific skill that was not swinging at pitches out of the strike zone. So players that walked a lot were all of a sudden valued, because in a batting average, a walk doesn't count as anything. But that's a very valuable thing. If you walk two batters and there's two batters on base, not only do you have chances to score in baseball, but your pitcher has gotten tired. So there's the wear and tear on that pitcher's arm. So there were a bunch of little things that Moneyball started measuring that weren't measured in the past. And the final piece of it was that the muscular fit players who could hit for distance were overvalued, and the not-so-muscular players who rarely would swing at pitches out of the strike zone were undervalued, and the Oakland A's made some great strides against their competition by following those two precepts.
It's all thanks to Brad Pitt, right?
That's Brad Pitt was the guy, yeah. He's a man of many talents.
Yeah, he is. That's a great book and a great movie, and if people haven't seen it or read it, I highly recommend it. So for us as volleyball people and volleyball coaches, what are the implications? What can we take away from that sort of thinking?
Well, I think that really started, I think, a lot of the statistical focus that we've seen in volleyball over the past 10 years. I think Gold Medal Squared has been on the forefront of that, looking at statistics and saying, hey, what really matters there? Obviously, their first contact statistics, their attacking side out and point scoring percentages. But then again, I think you can look at statistics, and one of my favorite quotes is, nothing lies like a statistic. So you can take an attacker who hits 300 with three kills and no errors in 10 attempts, and another attacker who has the same exact line hitting 300 with three kills and no errors, but the other seven of those attacks could be very, very different. Seven of those for one attacker could be putting a team in trouble, and seven of them from the second attacker could be giving that team a bunch of free balls, just rolling the ball to the libero. So if you won one with one hitter, you win 3 points out of 10, and the other hitter, you could win 10 points out of 10. So those two 300 hitters are very, very different because of what's really hidden behind those statistics. So that stuff is interesting to me.
What do you think is a more accurate way to do stats for attacking?
Well, I think there's one way is to take all those zeros, a zero being a ball that is not a kill and not an error, and to give those some value, maybe even a plus or minus. That's one way. Taking stats at the end of games. I mean, is a kill at 1-1 the same as a kill at 22-22? I think you can be very creative in ways you look at taking statistics. And I'm not really a math guy. I've played around with a bunch of different things, and I'm always playing around with stats and saying, hey, does this really measure success for what we're looking for our attackers? And for me, I'm a huge guy with, you know, not making hitting errors, especially hitting errors in the net. So a huge stat for us is looking at your errors, and we want more balls that are blocked than balls that are hit out or in the net. And so we want to challenge blocks. We want to challenge edges of the blocks with heat. And we think blocking at the high school level is probably one of the weaker skills, but a lot of kids at the high school level are afraid of blocks, so we want them to go after that. So for us, that's a stat that might not be a stat that a lot of people look at, but for us, it's very important.
Yeah, I don't think it's just at the high school level. We had Reed Pretty on the show, who's played at the highest levels, and I think he kind of had some of the same takeaways that it's really hard to block balls, and hitters often avoid the block too often. Why would you say you want to do stats, say, at different points in a match, say near the end of a match? Isn't every point equal value?
Well, I think every point is equal value as far as on the scoreboard. But when you look at, I think some players want to make big plays at the end of games, and other players might shy away from those situations. There are some times when if you're the ace attacker at 22-22 and everybody's ganged up on you, that they might not be ganged up on you like that at 1-1. So depending on the makeup of your team and the quality there, I think those, you know, I think there are big points in matches, and the players that relish those and are anxious to take that swing, I think there some players want to take the swing and some players would rather not. And I want to know that when I'm talking to my setter.
Is that something you've statted before, and have you found that there is differences in different points in the match?
I wouldn't be comfortable saying that I have enough stats to back up any type of, you know, valid answer to that question. Yeah. I just think that as I started looking at players and started seeing some players were very, very were much more successful earlier in sets than later in sets. And for me, that became something that I started to look at. And I started to look at it more. The biggest reason was to try to reinforce that with the players who were good at the end of matches, saying, hey, you know, in that match, after 20, you hit 400. You know, you hit, you know, 300 in the match, but after 20, you hit 400. Hey, you're a clutch performer. And that player goes, hey, yeah, I'm a clutch performer. I hit, you know, 400 after 20, you know. And so are there things that I can find to that have a statistical base that can help reinforce when our players do something well, I guess. Mm-hmm. And I'm always trying to be creative with that.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other kind of volleyball implications from the money ball stuff?
Well, I think there are all kinds of biases that we look at when we look at volleyball. I mean, I think right now, and you guys are I listen to your show all the time, and the word science is thrown around a lot, and I think there is a focus on science. If you say science, then you can't argue with it.
Mm. Yeah, that's how we trump the conversation. We just
you guys are. I mean, and once again, I'm teasing you a little bit, but I think a lot of coaches now say, well, hey, we're training ugly because the science says that everything has to look ugly, and that means it's better than anything that looks pretty. And for me, that's a little too simplistic. And so when I look at the science of, let's say, random and block training, how extensive have those studies been? Have they compared 100% random with 90% random and 10% block? Have they compared it with 80% random and 20% block? I'm always looking to try to get more random game-like training, but I'm an old-school guy that does still a bunch of block training. I don't know, John, if you remember, I came out to your beach practice.
Yeah.
Gave you notes, and I said, hey, you need some more block training.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely not an expert, and I think, you know, we wish Carl McGowan was still with us and could answer this better, but my understanding of the research on random and block training is that block training is really valuable when you're introducing a new skill. It's really it's helpful for the learner. It helps them understand what it feels like. So if we're working on something within passing, maybe shuffling to move, we want to introduce it in a block setting where it's very controlled, not to get them better at shuffling, but to get them to know what it feels like and to understand what that is. And once they have an understanding of what it feels like, what it looks like, then you want to spend as much time as possible in a random setting, working on that skill that they understood in the block setting. So it's not about, I guess, the percentage. It's getting them to, understand the skill so they can go do it in the wild in the more random setting.
Yeah, I get it, but I still believe that when you say you're introducing something new to a beginner, that is...
I don't think it has to be a beginner. It could be an expert. It could be to Billy, and it's just a new, something new within his technique.
Right. And Billy's he's a pro volleyball player on the ABB Tour, and you're saying that this is a new skill for somebody that has a bunch of different skills that are very, very close to that, and he's adding this to his skill set. Is that different than a player who's been in the gym two times in her life and she's 10 years old? And I find it interesting that all the random, McGowan and Marv Dumphy and the biggest proponents, what I would call the fathers of the game-like training in America have been men's coaches. Would you agree with that?
At high level?
Yeah, I agree, but I think that is kind of a separate point. They looked at the research done by motor learning professors and researchers on all sorts of sports at different levels.
No, I would agree with that, but when I've worked with a lot of 10-year-olds, and when you have a 10-year-old girl who isn't strong enough to serve the ball over the net, and she needs the technique in order to perform that skill correctly, that's different than pulling in a 14-year-old boy who's played basketball and soccer his whole life, and then comes in and says, serve like this. And they go, oh, like that? And they serve it over the net. Yeah, okay. Let's start playing volleyball. We can go into random training. And I want to get as much random game-like training as possible. But I think the pendulum has swung too far the other way for my taste, even though I'm trying to get more and more random training all the time. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think it's an interesting conversation. And yeah, a lot of it is, understanding your learner and meeting them where they're at. And
Do you guys know about the Daniel Coyle soft and hard skills?
Yeah, I've read some of that.
Yeah, and I think for me, he's the one who probably cleared that up the most, saying that for those hard skills, block training, what he seemed to describe as block training in the talent code made a lot of sense. And for soft skills, it's got to be random.
And Todd, can you give our listeners examples of hard and soft?
Yeah, so a hard skill would be, I'm a tennis player. So a hard skill is, swinging a tennis racket to hit a cross-court forehand. And so you watch a tennis lesson and somebody is doing that over and over and over. And the example in the talent code is they wouldn't even have a ball out there. They would have the Russian girls who were training at that Russian academy just swinging with no ball over and over and over. And there was no the soft skills then, involves the all of the reading that goes into, okay, when that server looks like this, I know the ball is going there. And, they've done studies with Roger Federer, and he doesn't have faster reflexes. His reflexes are in the normal category. But what he does is his reading skills are advanced. And so reading is a soft skill. So that needs to be performed in game-like situations, in random situations. You talk about, receiving a ball in soccer from 50 yards. That would be a hard skill. You do it over and over and over. You get a bunch of reps, bunch of reps, bunch of reps. That's a hard skill to just quiet the ball that you're receiving from 50 yards. And then once you can do that, then you say, okay, well, now I have defense, and now I have to receive it and keep a defender away. But then I have to go there to play the game, and I have to be able to not only stop that ball, but to put it in space to my teammates who are around me moving in directions with defenders there. And that's a soft skill, and that has to be done over and over and over in game-like situations. So that's my understanding. And once again, my disclaimer is I'm not a scientist. I read some stuff and act like I know what I'm talking about, but I don't. I mean, as a scientist, I have no scientific background at all.
Interesting. I'm sure there's a good formula kind of for every player, and that's going to be a matter of adjustments. As far as the biases, what do you see are some of the skills that are possibly overvalued in volleyball?
Well, I think the jump touch is probably the biggest one, because where everyone gets excited when somebody touches over 10 feet. And I would, a question is, how much better is 10 feet than 9'9"? Mm-hmm. And I don't know, on the beach, John, what is your jump reach, John, compared to...
Less than mine.
...AVP?
It's getting lower every year. I don't know.
Results have gone up every year.
Yeah, there you go.
They're an inverse relationship.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, that is interesting, because I remember reading something about, was it baseball hitting over, was it 300 or 400? There was like a big pay gap.
And, 300.
And like, really, what's the difference between that and 299 or whatever?
Yep.
Yeah.
We're out feet from a defender. So a defensive player who, a ball is hit, sideways, and that player takes off and runs it down, and that's eye candy. It's pretty to see, and you look at that and go, that's a great defender. They got a ball that nobody else could get. But maybe that's a defender, the ball doesn't hit their sweet spot very often when they're in serve receive or when they dig a ball, so they really can't control the ball, but they're very, very fast.
Todd, that was the story of my career. Ty Trambley was diving all over the place and looking flashy, and it doesn't look as cool when they hit the ball right to you.
I like it.
That's why Billy's still playing. What are some other ones, some other eye candy?
Tall setter, or even height in general. I mean, I'm a high school coach, and we play state in a state tournament, and I look at somebody's roster, and you just kind of scan down the roster, and how many sixes do you see? When I look down a roster, oh, they got seven kids over 6 feet. You know, we have two. We're in trouble. You know, I think so. I think that's a bias. Having a tall setter, how important is blocking for a setter? I think at different levels, that might the answer might be very different. But most people would probably agree that for setters, setting is the most important thing. I think with women, and especially with men coaches, I think attractiveness and having an attractive physique that looks in shape, I think that can be a huge bias. As coaches, do we want our players to look like they might be overweight? Is that something that, what if a player is great, but she doesn't look like she's great? Is that a bias that we have? Do we overvalue a strong physique? Do we undervalue a physique that might not be in the, you know, beautiful aesthetics category? But does that really matter with playing volleyball, especially now in a side-out situation where how many times are we really playing in, you know, indoor volleyball when we play matches when fitness is the difference? It might happen in the AVP. I'm not sure how much it happens in high school volleyball. If we're losing matches because of lack of fitness.
Right.
Yeah, that was one of the big Moneyball ones too. The scouts overlooked people who are overweight or things like that.
Yep. How about that vocal, expressive player with that tiger mentality compared to the player who has very flat affect? Do we see that tiger mentality as being more competitive? And could it be that that person with flat affect, that's just how he or she, that's just their personality. And they might be ultra competitive, but we just don't see it on first glance.
And I think you had, did you have two more here?
Yeah, the exaggeration of technique. So you'll see, this is one Russ Rose. I heard him say one time, he's all, I don't want players who look like they pass well. I want players who pass well. And I don't really care what it looks like. So he was a guy that, you know, talks about people being overly concerned with technique over the results. And he said, hey, we have some passers who, you know, I might not teach it the way they do it, but they're successful, and I'm not going to mess with it.
I think I'm definitely guilty of a number of those, and I'm sure a lot of coaches are, so it's good to become aware of our biases. So then what do you think are some possible undervalued skills in our sport?
I think, you know, with the, you know, I'm a women's coach. I coach high school girls, so I think hitting harder, I ask my players all the time, is that as hard as you can hit the ball? And I think hitting hard is something that's undervalued, especially we talked about the blocking issue earlier, and you combine those two things and you see how important it is to hit the ball hard. How about the player who every time they swing, they hit the ball in the middle of their hand? It's never hit off her wrist or his elbow. Every time they just have that hand-eye coordination where the ball hits in the middle of the hand. Is that undervalued? I'm a big guy on shaping attacks so you can hit trajectories, so you can hit, let's say, over the block into deep corners. Is that undervalued?
How do you train, say, something like getting that good contact on your swing?
You know, I think it's like a lot of things. I think that some people have an affinity for it, and I think you practice it and you can get better, but there will be some people who are going to be better the first day they walk in the gym, and it just happens every time. And, you know, how do they do that? I want to be able to teach someone, and they just have a better feel for it. I'm sure there are people on the beach in a bunch of skills that you can name. I don't know how that person does that. They never practice it, really. They just come in, and that's just the way they've always done it. But you can always improve, I think. And so for us, you know, we practice hitting the ball over the net every day. I mean, you know, working on arm swing mechanics and hitting the ball over the net is something we do a lot, and changing trajectories. So we try to hit the ball low so it's close to the tape, and then we try to hit the ball over the antenna. And there is a subtle timing difference to doing those two things, and players learn how to do that by practicing.
Yeah, and Billy is one of those guys who he gets a good contact every time, so maybe we should ask him. I think it was he started out playing with his dad when he was 8, and his dad would yell at him if he didn't get a kill. So is that it, Billy?
Just play for 30 years and it gets better.
I got about 10 more years to go. Okay, so what are some other undervalued skills?
Platform, contacting the ball in the sweet spot. The thing I think it's very difficult to define great liberos and players who are exceptional in serve receive. And I think one of the keys that I like to look at is, what does their platform look like when it's up by their shoulders and high? Can they tilt and establish an angle and not just turn their wrists? So I think the person that can hit the ball in their sweet spot when it's up by their shoulder, I think that's undervalued. Hitting a second tempo serve, I think, is undervalued.
What do you mean by that?
Well, for me, a second tempo serve is not a short serve. It's a low trajectory serve that bounces around 12 feet. But when it leaves your hand, it is the same height off the floor as it's traveling as a first tempo serve that is driven hard. So I don't know, we call it second tempo, or the other thing we like, it's hard to do on the beach, but indoors we call it a two bouncer. And that is, you make it bounce, if it's still low to the tape, but it bounces twice on the court, so it bounces on the 12-foot line, and then it bounces again, you know, at the 27-foot line or so, then you know that that's a good serve. It's that serve that drops off the table in front of you.
I think Billy's normal serve is a second tempo serve. That's his first tempo. So
yeah, I don't hit hard enough. Cool.
Yeah. Okay. So what? All right. So I like that
serve. That's an effective serve.
A lot of
teams now are very good receiving first tempo, but the vision of seeing the speed when the height when you're serving a short serve and you're going up and down trying to get it, you know, close to the net, the vision is much easier. But on the second tempo, the vision's tougher because the ball is served at the same trajectory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think depth is one of the things we have a really hard time reading.
Yep.
Okay, so what else do we got? Undervalued skills.
Your favorite, John. Slow to fast approaches, especially out of system. And you train that a lot. Do you have players that come in who have a good feel for it and you want to know how they got it?
Do I?
Is there a big range of players that come to you that some of them are very, very good at it and some of them it's very, very difficult to change them?
Yeah, I think they're at all different levels. I think that's one where most people, when they see the ball, they start fast, so it takes some time to change. But yeah, I mean, some get it faster.
I asked this question to a bunch of coaches. The six rotation left now is undervalued with all the subs we have now. And so a couple coaches talked to me about the idea of having that continuity rather than making all the subs, of having that six rotation left that can attack out of the back row and can serve receive and still play defense and has the ball control skills. And then, you know, we talked before about that player with flat affect, who there might be a lot of things going on behind that lack of emotion that you see, that you need to look a little closer rather than just taking the first look and saying, oh, she's not competitive because she didn't yell and scream after a great play or something of that nature.
When you're evaluating, let's say you're at a, you're having a tryout for your team, trying to decide who goes where, is there anything that you would do differently in order to kind of see some of these undervalued skills? Because obviously, like you said, somebody with that's very vocal and aggressive will stand out at a tryout. Somebody that's, you know, I don't know, tall, obviously. So is there anything you do differently in order to kind of like get a look at these undervalued skills?
Well, I think the first thing is the awareness of knowing about them. I think if you don't have awareness, it's tough to realize your biases if you don't understand them. So I guess that would be the first thing for me would be, hey, we have to understand that we can't just take a quick look and a player who is very vocal, we think that player is a great communicator because there's a lot behind communication. And maybe that player, you know, a player who is a great communicator with coaches might not be a great communicator with his or her teammates, especially if the coach's back is turned sometimes. So some of that is being aware of the biases. I think that's number one. And then making the whole coaching staff aware. The other thing that we try to fight is the confirmation bias. So we try to have different people looking and not talking about it. So I don't want a coach to come up to me and say, oh, did you see this player do this? I really don't want that because then I'm saying, oh, that coach thinks this player is good doing this. I want to really everybody to spit out everything at the same time and see if we have disagreements. And that as a head coach, I'm not saying something that is influencing my assistant coaches to have confirmation bias because they want to agree with me because I've been coaching 30 years and they've been coaching 3 years. I want them to have their own opinions and I want to get theirs before I get mine.
That was part one. Come back next week for more from Todd Baddocks and head over to patreon.com/coachyourbrainsout to support the show. Thanks.